Hi, this is Keith Wooden, and welcome to Story Mosaics. Thank you for joining us today, and I want to thank you for all the comments that you've given over the last 2 weeks. 2 weeks ago, we had Mickey come and speak, and actually, I had no idea how popular that episode was going to be. I think because it was right in the middle of the shelling that was taking place, but also because of the authority and understanding that Mickey brought to the table in explaining the situation. Mickey, I have to tell you that I have to do the analytics on all of my episodes. And this happened to be the second most popular episode that I've ever produced in the last over a year and a half. And so it's obvious that there's an interest in this. You might, as an audience, be interested in knowing that this episode came together in the actual shooting of it in the last 21 minutes, okay? Because we had talked about, I'd said I wanted to reserve the opportunity to have Mickey come back and speak, but you never know what events are transpiring in the news. And Mickey brings so much of an insight that we cannot ignore. And I had one viewer last time copy me on some information with regard to Israel. And he said, please, 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 please make sure you inform me next time Mickey is coming on. So Mickey, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for the opportunity. And I'm glad to be able to talk to you, though this time the rockets are not falling around, which is a great comfort for us. We're very, very happy about it. Another war in Israel is over and we survive. Praise the Lord for that.
And some people call this the 12-day war. Well, because we remember that there are several wars that Israel has been involved in that have been short in duration. Some people have been calling this the 12-day war, but it has seemed to be much more intense than anything. Even though during the historical wars of Israel, there was one point where you were being attacked from every side, literally every side. And God sustained you. And Mickey, we will come back on another episode, perhaps, and you go into the history of the Six-Day War, because it was an amazing thing. Or you might even want to go back to the history of the war in 1948, because it was just as amazing in God's preservation of Israel. And we can't get past this without acknowledging that there's a divine preservation here. And we don't have an opportunity just to dismiss that. And I know some people will maybe take issue with that, but as a historian, as you're a historian, it's hard to dismiss that concept. So, but we're going to be talking a little bit about some of the things that are still taking place, because even though the shelling has stopped, we are at a critical point in what will take place in the future. A 60-day truce, ceasefire, not truce, but ceasefire has been proposed. And that has a lot of implications. And as you called my attention to this, one factor is that Netanyahu has been meeting with President Trump even within the last hours, and that becomes a significant thing as well. So let's pick up on that, Mickey, and I know that you have an interest in that. So let's pick up on the truce. I said it again, because it's not really a truce. It's a ceasefire. But maybe you could pick up on the ceasefire and then the meeting between Trump and Netanyahu as you look through that lens. Can you do that for us?
Well, I think everybody in Israel, on the one hand, is excited over the end of the round with Iran a few days ago. But the war in general is not over. We still did not get our hostages back. We have about 20 hostages that are alive, and about 30 bodies of the people that were brutally murdered. on the 7th of October. And so this has not been over, and it's going on and on and on, because the enemy, the terrorist organization, has this very powerful card, which is the hostages. It's their last card. They don't have anything else. Israel was able to prove that it's capable to fight on various fronts. It was able to defeat the enemies that are at the borders, like Hezbollah. The situation in Syria has improved dramatically. And the enemies that are far away, which is Iran, also the despite of the public opinion, it seems that we have America, and especially American government and the president of the United States, on our side. So the last card that the terrorists have is this hostages.
Mickey, let me parse these three things that you spoke of here, because I spoke of the 12-day war, which was actually what was taking place with Iran. What's been going on with Gaza is now 600 and some days old, because it's a longer battle. What's happening in a shadow war in Syria with Hezbollah is another front. So there's actually three activities. Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, the northern front, Lebanon, Syria, has been quiet right now. There are other efforts there. It's multi diplomatic efforts now.
Okay.
And most of our military efforts are concentrated on Gaza and somewhat on Yemen as well, because Yemen is sending ballistic missiles
Yes.
to Israel, and it's far away and it's difficult to fight. We have very little intelligence on Yemen, so it will take a while before we can do something about it. I'm sure we will be able to do a lot of things there in Yemen. It just takes a little bit of time. I think Gaza is much more, if I may use the word, hot potato for us, because it's right here at our borders. And I wish, actually, we have a saying in Hebrew, I wish I was a fly on the wall in the a room where President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu had a meeting yesterday, but I wasn't. So I can only guess what is going on. And I was hoping that they will give a press conference, a common press, which they didn't, and that is not a very good sign. That means that the issue has not been resolved. And I think the main issue is who is going to rule Gaza at the end of the day. That's the thing. I don't think we have a clear answer on that. Because
as far as Netanyahu is concerned, and I would say the rest of the world needs to be concerned, Hamas is not an option to rule Gaza, even though they had ruled it in the past. It's just not an option. Am I understanding that correctly?
That is correct. Hamas is not an option, but we don't know what is the other option.
Yes.
That's the main challenge, because Hamas represents the people of Gaza, and it's part of the fabric of the society. It's very difficult to separate the two. I don't think you can say that this is a group of military men who just took over power, and as soon as you knock them out, they will be peace and quiet, and everybody will be happy. This is not the reality, unfortunately. Hamas is an ideology which embedded in the society that Gazans are part of. And it just happened to be that they were able to take charge. And in some ways, Israel was hoping that Hamas will counterweight the PLO. Am I clear on this one? The Palestinian Liberation Organization.
I haven't heard that term in a long time. So yes,
that's how it was born in late 80s or mid 80s as a counterweight for the militant Palestinian organization, but it turned to be monster itself. And unfortunately for me, and again, I have to be careful picking the words here, so please forgive me on that. It's part of the fabric of the society. They do represent the society there, and they had means. They were given power. They usurped some power as well, but people voted for them. They were given money. They were given funds. Most of the funds came from Qatar. Surprise, surprise. The money was given from Qatar, which acts as a mediator today, which gives me lots of doubt. What kind of mediator is that? If it was feeding and the some of the Hamas people are actually residing in Qatar, those who are negotiating, they actually do reside and get a full shelter in Qatar. It's not only Qatar, Turkey is involved in that as well. In the money, in other words, the money was given to Hamas, and Israel somewhat loosed the grip on them because they were hoping that the power structure of Hamas will be used to take care of their people, but they didn't do that. They actually invested mostly in the tunnel infrastructure. Well, that and we talk about the billions of dollars actually, and all this money that they received went into that because they realized how effective is that, the rockets and the tunnel system that they had. And so Israel's somewhat to blame also for the in power of Hamas, because Israel was hoping that Hamas can be the political answer to the problems in Gaza, but it obviously is blown up with Hamas invasion, and it showed the true intentions. The question is who else will be there? I actually do not have a clear answer on this question. It's extremely, extremely complicated. Depends on many, many factors. And I think Netanyahu is waiting for those factors to be ripe. But the problem is that it costs the life of the hostages. They cannot be there forever. They will die. And it cost the life of our soldiers. Every day we're losing soldiers. And it's really painful because we don't, we as a society, we as people who give those soldiers, we do not see the clear purpose, why they're dying. What's the purpose of their fight? So the prime minister has to explain this to the public now.
And of course, we're seeing such a loss of life in Gaza all the way around. I mean, we see the loss of life in Gaza as well. So we're seeing such an unknown outcome. There's not a clarity there for the Hamas or for Israel that is clear, because there's a muddiness of the situation as to who will take power in Hamas, in Gaza. And so there's a muddiness of the situation on every front. Man, as you were speaking, Mickey, you threw me a curveball, because I think our listeners need to understand, as you were talking about the money flowing through Qatar to Gaza and to Hamas in particular, then you just kind of threw in the fact that Turkey was also supporting in that area. And that becomes the complexity of this issue, because Turkey is a NATO nation. And so this makes I don't know whether our listeners understand the complexity of just that small piece of the puzzle, but we think it's small, but it's absolutely huge because of Turkey's alignment in the NATO Union. It just makes it very, very, very complex. So now, religiously, Turkey would be Shia, in terms of, no, it would be what?
Sunni. They're Sunni.
Sunni. It's Sunni. Okay. I just wanted to make sure because that distinction helped our audience a great deal. Can you once again let us know? Yeah, I'm going to tick off a few nations and you help me understand the ideological leanings. But we know that Iran is what alignment?
That's Shia. That's the largest Shia country.
Okay. And then we have Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia is probably the most rich, the richest Sunni country.
And then
And
we
there
have.
is a rivalry between the Sunni and Shia on the one hand, but there is also a rivalry between Sunni and other Sunni countries. You have a rivalry between Saudis and the what we call the Gulf nations there, which are very, very wealthy. The wealth came in the recent I don't know, 60 years or so, because of the petroleum that they have. Then you have Turkey that tries to dominate, and then you have Egypt that also a very large Sunni country. The population of Egypt is 100 million people. It's the largest populated country here in the Middle East. We can probably include Egypt, though it's in mostly in Africa, but we can include it into the Middle East because they're Arabs and they're Sunnis there. There are also problems within those major Sunni countries. For example, in Turkey, there is a tension between the secular type of the secular character of Turkey. It's probably the most secular country that or try to be the most secular country amongst the Muslim countries in the Middle East, beginning from the end of the World War I with Kemal Atatürk that proclaimed Turkey a republic, which is very interesting. It was a Sunni religious state as well, and the head of the last caliph of Turkey was also a religious figure, somewhat like in Iran, a person who is in Iran today. So they have this same thing in Egypt, actually. Same thing in Egypt. They do have a tension between the secular character and the religious groups, but the secular character there is represented by the army in Egypt.
Oh.
So it's an army dictatorship there, and it is a dictatorship. It's not a democracy there. It's run by a dictator. The Arab world is facing this major problem. They either have a if it's a secular country, it is a dictatorship. It can be a military dictatorship. It can be a royalty, like in Jordan. It's not a democracy as well. It's a dictatorship. It's just called the king there, or religious fundamentalism, which is Iranian, which is Iranian type. There's a complex of problems that I don't think Israel is able to resolve or America is able to resolve.
That's
What
right.
worries me, if I may, or what worries me in recent observations in the U.S. politics is the tendency of, I hope I pronounce it correctly, isolationism, to isolate the United States from the rest of the world and the problems of the rest of the world. This is nothing new, by the way. That
No.
happened in the United States in World War I. It happened with the United States in World War II. Of course now that it is if you zoom out in history, it does not make sense, because we are such a global economy, and
That's
you
right.
cannot isolate yourself anymore. It's just fooling yourself or fooling your audience that you should not support Israel, or you should not support Ukraine, or you should not support somebody else. I think it's a universal battle of good versus the evil, and we should be on the side of the good. Of course, you have to do that wisely, and there's lots of factors in it. There's no doubt about it. But isolationism never played good to the United States.
No, it's and like you say, it's been a historical policy. We have thought that because there are oceans between us, we don't need to be involved. And yet those oceans today are though in a past era they may have even been more insulary, the oceans today are not isolationist or insulary. They can be passed in just minutes with rockets. And now that we have seen in practice the hypersonic missiles and their use, I think eyes are being opened, not on all fronts, but eyes are being opened that we are a part, not just of a global economy, but of a global integration of factors. And so these issues cannot just be teased apart very easily. I'm with you, Mickey, is that normally at least there would have been a walkout press conference with no picture, really a photo op, but there was not even a photo op, or there, and there was not even an opportunity for us to get a sense of what had taken place behind those closed doors. And when I say photo op, we had a few pictures, but that was not the substance. We didn't see anything substantive coming out of Netanyahu and the talk that Trump had with him, which leads me to believe, like you, is that we're still in the thick of this. And I'm only hoping that a 60-day ceasefire will hold for a period of time in that arena. I'm still a little leery of the ceasefire that exists between Iran and Israel. That seems like a tenuous thing as well. Am I reading that right? I mean, or do you feel like that ceasefire with Iran is something that is going to seemingly stand?
Oh, that brings us, or it brings me to this whole interesting understanding, for me, a new understanding of the word treaty. It seems that between cultures we have very, very different understanding of the word treaty, what the treaty or covenant actually is.
That's very important. Thank
And
you for bringing this up.
What can be very, very clear for you and me is totally different in Arab Muslim culture. And that's what I've learned in this conflict. For them, and they have a number of words for that in Arabic that actually reflects the historical the history of various treaties that happened in the Muslim during the Muslim period, especially in the life of Muhammad, because of the high value of his life amongst the Muslim people. And so for them, the treaty is something that only goes one way. It's not going both ways. It only serves one party. The treaty is something that can only be good for me. I can be the down part, the down player of this treaty, but that's only because I'm weak now. And as soon as I get stronger, nothing binds me. So it's only about me. It's not about the other party. It's only about the other party when I can feel this other party. If I don't feel this other party, I'm free of any obligations. I don't have this. It's not obligatory. It's not going both sides. And
comes to the
you know,
the idea has always been, in some ways, treaties have been an opportunity to reload.
Absolutely.
That's the perspective.
Absolutely. And brings me, and that's how it was in the ancient cultures, apparently. And that brings me to this whole new concept that God introduced when he made a covenant with this little guy from Ur of the Chaldeans, or Ur of the Chaldeans, whatever way you corrupt it. You know, not with the powerful king, not with a powerful nation, but with this one guy. And he said, "I'll be faithful for you, no matter what. Not because you're so good, but because of my character, of God's character." And he proved to be faithful to not only to this one man, but to the family and to the nation that came out of this one man. And we can still see this faithfulness to this nation even today, which is totally amazing. This is not how those covenants or treaties work here. Saying all that is to show you that there is no official treaty with Iran, but even if it was, even if there was an official treaty with Iran, that would mean nothing to them. It would not be obligatory, binding, or anything like that. As soon as they become powerful, as soon as they can trick us, as soon as they can fool us and receive this capability of the atomic bomb, they will use it. They will implement this bomb without a blink. So we have to be aware of that. But that's with Iran, which at least represents the stable government. It's a bad government, but it's a stable government. In Gaza, we don't have the government. It's a total, forgive my Greek, chaos. It's chaos, and it's a jungle, and whoever has a gun has a power. Whoever, by the way, in Gaza has an access to the food trucks.
Yes.
They have the power. That's why they don't want the Americans to control the food trucks with distribution of the food to the people. They want to control it, and that will be their power. They will hold this power, and this is one of the main reasons Israel does not want to agree to this kind of terms in the 60 days truce.
I do think it's very, very, very important for people to understand how food and humanitarian aid has been manipulated in the past. And we don't have time to get into that, but the tunnels and the missiles, even though many of the missiles that they had at the beginning were more like, I would call them more similar to a bottle rocket that we have in our country. You know, you shoot it, you really don't know where it's going to land, but you just, it's with a wing and a prayer. You shoot it up in the air and it goes, but now it's much, 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 much more sophisticated. And so the missiles are landing at strategic targets. But here's the thing is, humanitarian aid is a complex and complicated issue, because even if you bring truck after truck after truck after truck into the nation, there is very little security in the idea that those foodstuffs are actually going to get to the people who need them. And so this is a very complex and complicated issue. And that's why the United States has offered to broker the humanitarian aid, only to be rebuffed from those within the nation or within the territory of Gaza, because it would need to come through the hands of the authorities. So complex issues there. Hey, I'm going to, Let me make sure that we've not exhausted anything here, but I think I'd like to turn the corner slightly, but there may be something else that you want to add to our discussion before I turn the corner into another part of the world that Israel still plays a very major part in. Anything else you wanted to add to our discussion there thus far?
Well, and again, if we zoom out a little bit, and I will not say anything new, but what we have here in this conflict is disproportional warfare. Israel, being a democracy and part of the Western nations, is expected to carry the war by the rules of the war, okay, with its limitations, like the humanitarian aid, for example, or not killing the non-combatants, etc. Those are rules of engagement that Israel is binded, but these are not binding rules for the other side, and they look at us and they see those rules and limitations as the weakness. They already expect that they can do whatever atrocities they want. They can use their civilians population as a shield, and then they expect the humanitarian aid. Now that does make sense, but that's the reality on the ground. So it's already for the advantage. And of course they're using this, and it's very difficult. It's very difficult to fight. I think the Americans experienced that somewhat in Vietnam.
Yes.
Of course, the fact that this conflict was not at American soil or close to American soil sort of ended this conflict rather quickly without I think without a major victory for the United States.
No. In fact, one of my friends just celebrated his return some 40 years after the events of Vietnam, and he talked about his re-engagement in the United States after that war, and it was sobering to look back on that era as individuals from the United States. Yeah, let me call attention to something, and this is just a little bit of an aside, but it's a factoid, if you will, that helps us understand that the largest concentration of Jewish population outside of Israel is in New York City. And so it's a very important thing that we understand that no matter how you parse this, there is a strong alliance, if you will, of individuals within the United States towards the cause and the security of Israel. Let me take us on a little bit of a journey because I know that you immigrated to Israel many years ago with your family. Your ties are back with Russia, and I'm not expecting you to be an authority on this topic necessarily, but it's an important topic nonetheless. And that is what is a perceived inequity among many here in the United States between our support for Israel and our almost ignoring the needs of the Ukrainian people. And so I woke up on July 4th. I no matter what, I'm always going to bed early and I miss the fireworks. But I should say I woke up on July 5th and I witnessed the tape of all of the mortar shells that were being fired from the Brooklyn Bridge and the ships that were there in the harbor there into the air in celebration of our freedom. And there were over 80,000 shells launched into the air for our entertainment. And at the same time as I was watching that, there were over 5,000 drones and missiles that were being launched into Kyiv. And the explosions that were there were so different from the explosions celebrating our freedom. And it just struck me. And my heart goes out to the Ukrainian people in this war. And yet it seems like the United States has pulled back significantly, not seemingly, that's been publicized, pulled back from support of the Ukraine. And certainly even in its defensive realm of trying to defend itself against these drones and the like. And so here's my issue. And the tension that I feel is, as you look on and you see what's happening in the Ukraine, give me your perspective. And I recognize, I want every one of our listeners to understand, I'm asking Mickey not to speak as someone who is an authority on a subject matter here, but one who understands the region and what is taking place there. So Mickey, I would love for you to speak into the issues that you see and the United States actions in the Ukraine and Russia's actions in the Ukraine and the political alignments that are taking place there. Can you do that? Have I given you a huge, huge issue to parse out here?
Well, I can try, but maybe my answers can be viewed as simple. But that's what I see as being an outsider. And again, please forgive me. My criticism, I'm not trying to be critical, I'm just trying to be analytical. And I think, and correct me, I think President Trump's agenda is to bridge peace between the nations that are in conflict. I think that's what he declared from the beginning of his time in the office as a president of the United States. And there are some successes in that. For example, between India and Pakistan, definitely there was a success. There is a certain success in the Middle East, I think. And he was hoping that he would be able to work his magic, quote unquote, on President Putin. And it didn't work. It just did not work. Interestingly enough, it brings me back to 200 years ago history, when another very, very powerful leader, probably the most powerful leader in Europe of those days, and that was Napoleon Bonaparte, that invaded Russia in 1812. And he was a brilliant general, and he had a total success in Russia, and he was able to burn Moscow. And he was hoping that the Russian Tsar will come up to him, and they will negotiate certain conditions of a certain peace. I don't think Napoleon had any ideas of conquering Russia or ruling Russia. That was, he just wanted for his political whatever reasons. And what is interesting, that the Russian Tsar never came. And Napoleon was waiting and waiting and waiting, exhausting his resources. And finally, he gave up. He just realized he cannot sit there forever. And he just pulled back. And the Russian Tsar never showed up, and they were able to regain their influence in Europe again. The Russians did not defeat Napoleon; it was the British, but they allied with the British, and that's what helped to bring Napoleon down at the end of the story, as we know. So that somewhat reminds me of that history, that President Trump was hoping to exercise whatever reasons he had to the president to the president of the Russian Federation, but it just didn't work. He's not interested, and that means that the conflict will be going on and on. The only thing is, another thing is that you should not underestimate American help. There's still American help that goes to Ukraine, and it's economical help, and there are certain defense weapons that they give. But that there it brings us to another problem of NATO. The NATO countries, which is in Europe, because Ukraine is a European problem more than an American problem.
Yes.
And the NATO was so much dependent on the United States that they said Americans will pay our defense budget. They will protect us, basically, from the communists. This has to be changed. I think on the latest summit of NATO that took place about a week ago, the NATO members were pressed by President Trump to raise their defense budget. The European countries has to pay more into their defense, take their defense much more seriously, because Russia is a serious threat to the European Union, and it's very also very complicated. And what is painful for me, that the of course the Ukrainian people are paying the very very heavy price, both the soldiers and the civilian and the civilian population. Unlike Israel, they do not have a well developed home front that can protect their civilians. They're much more exposed. There are many more casualties, many more casualties there. So it's my heart goes with the of course with the Ukrainian and with the Ukrainian people. That's of course very painful.
And I think you've drawn an interesting parallel, is that essentially Russia's taken a posture that we may go to meetings, we may attend phone calls, but we're not changing our strategy. You've given us no compelling reason to change our strategy with Ukraine. Now, and you said, make no mistake, there is definitely a participatory element of the United States in the Ukraine battle, even to this day. I don't imagine that in any way the strategic elements of what has taken place inside of Russia from the Ukraine attacks. We'll take the Air Force attack from the drones that were spirited into the nation, or take a few of the attacks upon infrastructure areas. I think we can't separate out the parts of this that include the United States's intelligence and their ability to deploy that intelligence worldwide. And so we may not see a bomb from this place to that place transferred, but intelligence is something that and in fact I heard one person say of Israel intelligence, we're going to wait on Israel. This was talking about what was taking place in the Straits of Hormuz and the like. We're going to wait on Israel intelligence within Yemen to tell us what our next step is. And I thought, wait, we don't have any intelligence in Yemen. What's the case? Well, we recognize that Israel's intelligence is in many, many places far exceeds our intelligence in certain regions. And so it was a telling mark there. Be a bit of a prognosticator. I'm going to ask you to be a prophet, if you will. But I would say that from my perspective, and this is one of the fears that I have, is that this Ukraine also is a buffer down to Lebanon, Syria. You know, these all connect: Turkey, Lebanon, Syria, and then Israel. The Ukraine still stands as a buffer there, between forces that seem to have ideological ideas about not only Israel's existence, but its strategic placement. So I'm going to ask you to be a bit of a prophet and a prognosticator here. Can Ukraine fall?
Well, Keith, you know what they do with the prophets, that their prophecies are not being actually, that prophecies are not happening.
Oh, this is very, very good.
I think Winston Churchill said that the good politician is the one who can explain to his public why his promises could not be fulfilled. Russia has much, much more resources, both human resources to fight, natural resources, economy, and territorial resources. Ukraine is much smaller, and their resources will come to an end. I'm afraid that we might have a very similar scenario with Czechoslovakia of 1938. When Hitler demanded Czechoslovakia to be given to him, the European powers, and especially Britain, and Chamberlain, who was the prime minister at this time, he flew back to London with the piece of paper, and you could see this footage. It's documentary. It's filmed. You can see Mr. Chamberlain with this piece of paper and saying, "I have brought you peace," and that was 1938. That was 1938, we know that this peace did not last long. It was just another step to the war, and that also shows you the value of the treaties between democracies and non-democratic dictatorships like Hitler had. So yes, the fate of Ukraine can be very, very tragic. What will happen after Ukraine? I think Russia's idea was to maintain the communist bloc. So I don't think they want to invade France or England. I don't think that's in their plans. But Eastern European nations, especially the small nations like the Baltics, which are very, very small countries, which are part of the EU, all of them, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, all of them are part of EU with a very small population, which is hardly over a million people there. So it's very, very small. They're afraid that they will be swallowed by the Russians next. We don't know. They also have some ambitions in the south, in the countries like Georgia, for example, that can also, they wanted to be part of NATO, and so that worried Russia a lot, and so that brings us that brings this conflict closer to us, to Caucasus, to the Middle East, etc. So we don't know, but it can be very, very tragic, and I think, in my opinion, the Ukrainians will submit to the draconical conditions of the Russians, and they will shrink in their territory. I think that's the price that they will pay. I don't know how long it will take, because they showed a good capacity, but their resources are limited. So I'm afraid I can only be a sad prophet, someone like Jeremiah, who actually was warning Judah not to fight with the Babylonians. Don't fight with a big dog. It's too big of a dog, etc. But the king didn't listen, and he died. I don't want to draw a direct line between those two, but things like that happened in the past.
I think, this is why, first of all, understanding the territories that are involved. And this is why the isolationist view is such a dangerous, dangerous, dangerous position. we have to view and understand the territories involved very clearly. And I would imagine that only a small percentage of the American people could even tell you where the nations that you've just listed off, where they even are on a map. I hate to say that, but we are in that isolationist idea. Secondly, this is why my heart has always beat so closely with yours, is I am a historian by nature. And when I heard some of the phrases used for the Ukrainian, if you will, surrender of land for peace in our time, it made me very, very retrospect to 1938. And I agree with you. I don't think Putin has his eyes on the European nations. I really don't. But I do think he has his eyes on these small countries and these other areas. And that's why, for me, Ukraine becomes the litmus test of whether we will surrender to his agenda or whether we will hold him accountable to those. And so we are up against some very important issues in our world today. Mickey, there's a few other areas, and so though we may not do it in 2 weeks, there are a few other areas that I have to come back to and say, okay, Mickey, I need your insight. Historically, I want to get your perspective. And of course, I'm always having to keep my finger on the pulse of what's happening worldwide, because it may be that in 2 weeks that our whole situation has changed. And so, thank you for appearing with us again this time. And I don't think you're in the bunker today, are you? You're in your living room.
I am in the bunker. Turned it in such a comfortable study that I don't want to move out of here. It's okay. Everything is prepared. I have my water. You had to go to get your water there. I was almost suggesting you that I have plenty of water in my bunker that I can give you some. The computer is here, internet is here, that is here. I can sleep, I can eat, I can read, I can browse on the internet. No, I'm not going to leave. The only what I'm afraid of, that you will ask me in 2 weeks to say something about China, so I have only 2 weeks to learn Chinese, and that is mission impossible.
Possible, this is, but you know. I promise to keep my hands off of China in the near future for your sake. But there are issues there, aren't there?
Absolutely.
Hey, Mickey, thank you so much. I want to reassure you, one of the things that came out of our last meeting, I had so many people responding, and I think I let you know about a little bit, but so many people were responding to your post and to my post about how we were praying for your family, okay? And so, what came out of that was very, very powerful, in that many people have been praying for you and your daughters and your wife, and we feel closer to you because of that, and we will continue to pray. Okay, my brother?
Thank you. This is something that the money cannot buy. It's something that binds us and connect us, this is my biggest appreciation to this kind of time that we have. Thank you.
I want to let people know, first of all, you always have a channel by which to reach out to me, and that it helps us. You can comment about these on our Facebook page. You can comment by sending a note to story.mosaics1, story.mosaics1@gmail.com, and let us know what your thoughts are. Maybe even let us know what your future questions are, because we found an opportunity to speak with somebody who understands a larger context than what we understand here in the States. That's given us a great opportunity to expand our influence as well. Continue to pray for Mickey and his family, and thank you for joining Story Mosaics.
Hello, Shalom.